he'll be the good buddy of Otto von Ballschwing, Alan Dulles, and this entire unsavory concatenation that, again, I call the politics of the elders of oil. Another thing that's worth bearing in mind in connection with the investigations into some of the bin Laden terror is that the fellow who was in charge of investigating the bin Laden organization and the bombings into U.S. embassies in Africa, and we're going to come to that, was an FBI official named John O'Neill, who was quoted in a book that's just been published in France as saying that basically what interferes with these terror investigations is the politics of oil. And he specifically discussed the murder of a German Verfassungsschutz agent and his wife, and they were in Libya investigating some of these old Mueller intelligence connections to some of the terrorist incidents in Germany. John O'Neill, I'm going to talk about that as I get up to 2000. Bear in mind that John O'Neill, in August of 2001, was hired as the director of security for the World Trade Center and was then killed in the attack. So now the point man in the Justice Department investigation of the bin Laden organization died in the World Trade Center attack, which is very, very interesting indeed. Now, in the late 1990s, Bill Clinton faced impeachment, and right as his impeachment hearings were reaching a peak, the U.S. embassies in East Africa were bombed by the bin Laden organization, and that placed Bill Clinton in an interesting position. A lot of the people who were his more liberal or left-leaning supporters attacked him. You heard him scoured on the Pacifica Network, for example, for launching cruise missiles against alleged bin Laden associates or elements associated with that. It should also be noted that when bin Laden was harbored in Sudan, the Saudi intelligence chief, who was sort of the Saudi government liaison with bin Laden, visited him three times, visited him many times, and tried to talk him into coming back to work for the family business. The bin Laden family three times dispatched operatives to Sudan to try to talk Osama into coming back. It is said that Osama does not help with the family business. He inherited something like $80 million when his father died in 1967. That's a lot of money today. That's many, many more than $80 million, which is a nice piece of change as is. And it's said that Osama has no role in running the family business. That's not true. One of his sons, Abdullah, helps to run the Saudi bin Laden family. So, to a certain extent, this is smoke and mirrors. But I would note that as the Republican right, with their strong connections to the petroleum industry, through organizations like the Carlyle Group, to the bin Laden family, and through the BCCI and this whole covert operations network, again, that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, which is a pretty good one when you think about it. Bear in mind that as Clinton was facing impeachment by the Republican right, at the same time, bin Laden chooses to attack Clinton literally from the left, from a political standpoint, by attacking the U.S. embassies. He placed additional pressure on Clinton from the left, because basically Clinton was being excoriated for taking the cruise missile attacks against the alleged bin Laden targets. I would note that if Clinton had not taken that action, then he would have been fodder for the talking heads, which then would have said, well, this proves that we have a terrorist attack against American property, American lives have been lost, threats of additional action, and here we have a powerless president who will not take action. That would have been used to push Clinton's impeachment. So he was between the devil and the deep blue sea. He ultimately, we'll see if we have time to go into this, but he ultimately was completely discredited. And I'll tell you, one of the things, there's an old expression, there's nothing like stepping in a cow flop to make you realize how nice tripping over a stone can be. I think Bill Clinton had a very, very bad rap. I don't think he was nearly as bad a president as a lot of people seem to think. One thing people forget is that he wasn't elected with a majority in 1992. Most people voted for Bush or Perot, and then from 1994 on, he had two hostile houses of Congress, a hostile media, a hostile left, a hostile judiciary, and a hostile damn bloody well near everything else. He was lucky to get out of there with his skin. And one of the things that helped to discredit him in the end, in the eyes of many, was the Mark Rich pardon. Mark Rich was one of the key operatives cited in the final congressional report on the BCCI. He was involved in using BCCI, among other elements, in trafficking weapons to both Iran and Iraq. And the guy who lobbied Clinton on behalf of Mark Rich, who's based in Switzerland, and whom I personally believe to be a Borman operative, was a guy named Jack Quinn, who also lobbied the Bush administration on the behalf of Larry Silverstein, who leased the World Trade Center just before the attacks, and in fact had just leased it so recently before the attacks that no insurance policy had been written on the World Trade Center. That is now a focal point of major litigation. Swiss Re is suing. That's one of the stocks that was suspiciously traded in the run-up to the 9/11 attacks, along with Allianz and Munich Reinsurance. One of the companies investigated in connection with that suspicious trading is Altaqua, on whose board of directors Alfred, now Ahmed Huber, sits. And again, some of these connections, I'm repeating some of these often enough so that it hopefully will not be too confusing in retrospect. Now, Clinton obviously did not get impeached, but Al Gore himself was never able to shake the stigma of Clinton's alleged immorality. I mean, yeah, he basically got a blowjob and a big deal. I mean, when you think about it, you think about all the stuff, and just think about some of the connections I've been talking about here. A blowjob is pretty damn innocent. That is the least of our pipeline problems under the circumstances. And let's take a jump up to the 2000 election. Now, again, you've got George W. Bush, the great-grandson of George Herbert Walker, one of Hitler's earliest financial backers. He's the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the central players in all of this stuff. His first energy company is capitalized in part by the Bin Laden family, or at least the North American business representative of SANE. He also is a financial beneficiary of the Carlyle Group, in which his father is very, very active, along with James Baker, who recruited the Palestinian moderates, who became the negotiating team in the Oslo Accords. A lot of interesting things happened in the 2000 campaign. All of a sudden, with an oil man as president and with Dick Cheney, his father's defense secretary, as vice presidential candidate, Dick Cheney also the CEO of Halliburton Oil, the largest petroleum exploration company in the world, and the company which eventually acquired Dresser Industries, the company for which the elder George Bush went to work at the behest of Henry Neal Mallon and Alan Dulles all the way back at the end of World War II. Again, the politics of the elders of oil. We have a petroleum industry candidacy in 2000 on the Republican ticket. Oil man Bush, oil man Cheney, and surprise, surprise, the price of oil begins to go up, and the price of gas goes up, and this causes the stock market speculative bubble to burst, because basically it became clear that the economy was not going to be doing that well because the price of oil was going up, and when you increase the price of oil, everything inflates because everything uses petroleum directly or indirectly, so the price of everything, whether governmental or for-profit or otherwise, goes up. And that cuts into everybody's profit margin, and even and consumers get hurt in the same fashion. During the 2000 campaign, a number of interesting things were going on. In the first place, the elder George Bush was in touch with Crown Prince Abdullah of the Saudi royal family, one of the descendants of King Ibn Saud, who is friendly with Mohammed bin Laden, and again, the hip bones connected to the thigh bone, et cetera, et cetera. Crown Prince Abdullah is going to succeed King Fahd, who apparently is about as sentient at this point as that doorknob. He's pretty much had it, and he's going to be succeeded by Crown Prince Abdullah, who is Osama bin Laden's number one contact and protector in the Saudi royal family. And Crown Prince Abdullah was in contact with the elder George Bush through the Carlyle Group during the campaign. So perhaps it's not all that surprising that gas prices went up, helping to torpedo Al Gore's candidacy as Jimmy Carter's had been torpedoed in 1980 when oil prices once again went up, when once again the Saudi-Bush petroleum connection came into play in a big, big fashion. And then von Bolschwing protege Helena von Baum picked all of the cabinet members for which, basically, that Ronald Reagan selected. She picked the list from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments. Now, on July 26th of the year 2000, you want to go back, get the New York Times from that date, look on the front page, because at this point, Bill Clinton was attempting to broker a successful peace negotiation between Otto Skorzeny protege Yasser Arafat and his negotiating team, including Hanan Ashrawi. Again, Baker's dozen. They were coached by the CIA. They were proteges of James Baker, who, along with the elder George Bush, is involved with the Carlyle Group. And on July 26th of the year 2000, the front page of the New York Times had two very important stories. The most important story was that Yasser Arafat walked out of the Camp David Accords that President Clinton was attempting to, through which he was attempting to successfully realize an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord. Had Clinton successfully done that, and if that accord had gone through, and bear in mind, a lot of people don't know what Ehud Barak had actually agreed to. Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in 1995. He was succeeded by a right-wing Israeli, Benjamin Netanyahu, himself with a political heritage dating back to the fascist element and the Zionist movement. But then Netanyahu was defeated by Ehud Barak, who won the presidency, and Barak went back to the peace process. And he essentially staked his reputation on successfully brokering the negotiations with the Palestinians. And in these negotiations, basically, the Palestinians were going to get 95% of the occupied territories back. They were going to have an official Palestinian state recognized by Israel. Barak agreed to that. And they were going to get to share Jerusalem as a capital, although they were not going to have exclusive possession of Jerusalem. Basically, to make a long story short, if you're ever in a negotiating position and you can get 95% of what you want, go for it. That is an unrealistic expectation. If you can get 80, you're making out like a bandit. 95 is not realistic. Yasser Arafat walked out because he didn't get 100%. What he would have had was 95% of the occupied territories back, and he would have had a Palestinian state and access to Jerusalem. Barak could not give up 100% of the occupied territories because that basically was political death for him. However, Arafat walked out. That very day, the other lead story in the New York Times was that Bush had named Dick Cheney as his vice presidential candidate. Bear in mind that the Carlyle Group employed James Baker as well as the elder Bush. They were in touch with and did business with Crown Prince Abdullah, who was Osama bin Laden's main protector within the House of Saud. One of the things I wonder, and this is a conspiracy theory, now of course had Bush, had Clinton successfully brokered the Oslo peace process between Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak, that might very well have given Al Gore the election victory. It would have been a tremendous thing, giving the Democrats momentum in the 2000 campaign. Bear in mind also that the first and today only Jewish vice presidential candidate was running on along with Al Gore, and that was Joseph Lieberman. That, I'm sure, did not sit too well with the House of Saud, the politics of the elders of oil, and all the people that I have been talking about. With the Palestinian negotiating team having been composed of people like Hanan Ashrawi and these other so-called moderate Palestinians, again, proteges of James Baker involved with Carlyle Group and this whole mess, one of the things I wonder about, and I would bet on it if there were a way of verifying it, was that the Republicans actively interfered in the back channel with the Camp David peace negotiations, much as Henry Kissinger interfered with the peace negotiations that were taking place in 1968 between the North Vietnamese and the Johnson administration. Had an effective ceasefire been worked out, and Johnson was working on that, that might very well have given Hubert Humphrey the victory in 1968 instead of Richard Nixon, the protege of Allen Dulles and all the rest. By the way, the elder George Bush is a political protege of Richard Nixon. It's actually just one big, not very happy family. Actually, probably real happy, but it would be sort of like the political and petroleum equivalent of the Manson family. But sometimes go to a library and get a hold of the New York Times, July 26th of 2000, and look at the front page. Lead story, Arafat walks out of Camp David. The second lead story, Bush picks Cheney, again, head of Halliburton. I suspect that that was no coincidence. And I would be willing to bet, as a matter of public record, that the elder George Bush was in touch with Crown Prince Abdullah through the, in part, bin Laden family-financed Carlyle Group at this time. I'll bet you they were not only arranging to raise the price of oil, but also to scotch the Camp David Accords to see to it that Bill Clinton could not present something which would be something of a trump card for his alleged immorality, et cetera, namely a successful brokering of a Palestinian-Israeli peace accord which would have provided for a Palestinian state. Well, when the Camp David Accords broke down, And when the new Intifada took over, Barak was voted out of office, and Ariel Sharon, again from the Israeli right wing, which also has some interesting connections back to the fascist element within the Zionist movement, they got into power, and the whole thing lit up in a big, 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 big way. And that's sort of where we stand vis-a-vis the Middle East. Also, in the summer of 2000, John O'Neill, the FBI agent in charge of investigating the Bin Laden investigation, had a briefcase stolen from him in Tampa, Florida. That briefcase detailed every counterterrorist and counterintelligence operation in New York City, including manpower allocations. That is a very, very interesting theft indeed. Now, I wonder who took it and what relationship that might have had to what was about to take place a little over a year later in New York City. This is the summer of 2000. In October of 2000, the USS Cole is bombed in Yemen. That is the destroyer that was now, we know, bombed by the Bin Laden organization. One of the people linked to the Cole bombing was also linked to the World Trade Center attacks and to the murder of this German Verfassungsschutz agent in Libya. And that, in turn, was something that was being investigated by John P. O'Neill. Once again, in the 2000 campaign, we have rising oil prices, we have Middle Eastern extremism and Middle Eastern terror, once again making the Democrats look weak and placing pressure on the electorate. Well, we know that, obviously, the 2000 campaign was very, very close. We also know now that Al Gore won, but that was not the way things were to turn out to be, because James Baker, again, from Carlyle Group, the sponsor of Baker's Dozen, who constituted the Palestinian negotiating team that walked out of the Camp David negotiations in 2000. James Baker leads the vote fight in Florida, and of course the governor of Florida is Jeb Bush, who among other things was his father's liaison to the anti-Castro Cuban milieu in Florida in connection with the Iran-Contra affair. The younger George Bush, obviously, becomes president of the United States, courtesy of the Supreme Court, and a number of interesting things happened in the summer of 2001 or the spring. The revelation of additional documents in connection with the Oklahoma City bombing leads to the resignation of Louis Freeh as FBI director. He is then replaced by Robert Mueller, who basically was less than vigorous in his investigation of the BCCI, with links to the Afghan support effort against the Soviets in the 80s, the Iran-Contra affair, James R. Bath, Arbusto Energy, the Bin Laden family, the Bin Mahfouz family, who also were linked to the Muwafaq Foundation, another alleged al-Qaeda front. And again, that's not a name you want to mispronounce on the air. Mueller also was less than vigorous in his pursuit of the bombing of Pan Am 103 and the prosecution of Noriega. He was a George I Bush, Justice Department insider. He becomes head of the FBI in early July of 2001. In late July of 2001, J.H. Hatfield, the author of the book Fortunate Son, which talked about George W.'s drug use and also documented the Bush Bin Laden family connection to Arbusto Energy, by the way, as did Pete Bruton in his book, The CIA, the Mafia, and George Bush. J.H. Hatfield dies at the ripe old age of 43 of an alleged drug overdose. So long, J.H. Hatfield. Then, in the summer, in August of 2001, hours before they were set to begin, the Saudi military cancels its annual scheduled military maneuvers with the United States. Then, on September 1st of 2001, Crown Prince Abdullah, again Bin Laden's main defender in the Saudi royal family, and the person who was in touch with the elder George Bush under the auspices of the in part Bin Laden family-financed Carlyle Group, he is in touch, Crown Prince Abdullah is in touch with the elder George Bush in the summer of 2000. Crown Prince Abdullah warned George the Younger, George II, 10 days before the attacks, that his stance on the Israeli-Palestinian question, which was to keep hands off, was unacceptable. That's a very interesting, that's been pretty much blacked out in the American press. 10 days before the attacks, Crown Prince Abdullah tells George, you better change your stance on the Israeli-Palestinian question. Shortly after that, the younger George Bush, for the first time, endorsed a Palestinian state. The week Before the attacks took place, Saudi Arabia changed their intelligence chiefs for the first time in 20 years. The guy who was the outgoing Saudi intelligence chief was known to be the Saudi National Security Establishment liaison with Osama bin Laden and had made several trips to various places where bin Laden had been stashed. Oh, also, a couple of interesting things happened in May of 2001. In May, the Bush administration gave the Taliban $43 million because of their heroic efforts in combating the drug trade. And also, Arnaud de Borgrave, who was the editor of the Moon Organization-sponsored Washington Times, and there are strong connections between the Moon Organization and the Bush family. The elder George Bush has picked up spare change in addition to working for the Carlyle Group. He's been making speeches for the Moon Organization in Latin America. Arnaud de Borgrave makes a trip allegedly to Afghanistan to interview none other than Osama bin Laden. Arnaud de Borgrave, with very strong connections to the intelligence community, I do not know if he actually interviewed Osama bin Laden, but that's pretty damn interesting considering that Osama bin Laden was being pursued at this time. In August of 2001, John O'Neill leaves the FBI. He was in charge of the bin Laden investigation. He was the guy that had the briefcase burglarized in Tampa in the summer of 2000, detailing every counterintelligence and counterterrorist operation in New York City at that time, including manpower allegations. He leaves the FBI and goes to work as the security director for the World Trade Center. He is killed in the attacks, thereby silencing him. He also was very critical of the investigation into bin Laden, saying that oil industry politics interfered with the investigation. In the summer of 2001, and I believe this was on July 23rd, but the date may be wrong, a guy named Larry Silverstein leased the World Trade Center for 99 years, capitalized in considerable measure by a General Motors subsidiary and by UBS Warburg, which is a major Bormann-connected bank in Switzerland that whose director at the time owned 25% of the stock for the IG Farben holding company, Interhandel. UBS is a major Bormann-connected bank. The Bormann organization uses Jewish individuals in the United States as front persons as well as elsewhere, makes a very obvious cover for a Nazi capital organization. Larry Silverstein had just leased the World Trade Center, and he had just leased it so recently before the attacks that no insurance policy had been formally written. Among the stocks, again, that were suspiciously traded in the run-up to 9/11 were the Swiss Reinsurance, which has 22% of the liability in the World Trade Center attack. They're now suing Larry Silverstein, Munich Reinsurance, Allianz, and a number of other companies whose their stock was allegedly suspiciously traded. One of the companies that is being investigated in connection with that, again, Al-Taqwa Management, an alleged Al-Qaeda funding source. One of its board of directors is Ahmed May Alfred Huber, an associate of the German neo-Nazi NPD, the top American contact, or top German contact group of the National Alliance, publisher of Serpent's Walk. And Ahmed May Alfred Huber goes all the way back to the Institute for the Study of Zionism under Goebbels' anti-Semitic propaganda chief, Johann von Leers, back in Nasser's Egypt under the Skorzeny mission, along with the Grand Mufti and this whole crew that I've been talking about. Interestingly, the person with the most to gain and the least to lose in connection with World Trade Center is Larry Silverstein, who made out like a bandit, if, as I suspect, he's a Bormann front person, then that gives the Bormann organization the capital from the insurance settlement in connection with the World Trade Center building. They also were in all likelihood involved in the insider trading. Plus, there was very suspicious action in something called the Standard & Poor's 500 Index put options. Now, I don't understand the high finance behind this, but there are options that you can use to buy and then sell short on the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And normally, as the expiration date for these approaches, they decline in value. But in the run-up to 9/11, the S&P 500 index options did not decline, as is normally the case. And if someone invested 100 contracts They basically would have invested $120,000, which would be simple for the Borman organization. They would net $780,000 on that transaction. There was very unusual activity in the Standard & Poor's 500 index put options. So in all likelihood, the Borman Group made out like a bandit in the run-up to 9/11, speculating in securities that they knew were going to depreciate in value, including insurance stocks, parent companies of United and American Airlines. They also, I suspect, were profiting from Larry Silverstein, the guy who lobbied the Bush administration successfully on behalf of Larry Silverstein, and a lot of the bailout, basically, are going to eliminate his liabilities or his the potential lawsuits in connection with 9/11. It's a guy named Jack Quinn, who was the guy who had lobbied Bill Clinton on behalf of the Mark Rich Party. So that's a very interesting coincidence there. I suspect that is not a coincidence. Again, the week before the attacks, the Saudis change intelligence chiefs. The bin Laden protector, their bin Laden liaison man, is out for the first time in 20 years, and a new guy is in. In the World Trade Center attacks, John O'Neill, is killed, thereby eliminating anything he might have had to say about the bin Laden organization. A lot of movement in and around the attacks. Shortly after the attacks, the American-based members of the bin Laden family are flown out of the United States in a private Saudi jet before they can be questioned by the FBI. The bin Laden family's geographical base in the United States is Boston, where the two planes that crashed into the World Trade Center took off from. Again, that's a very interesting coincidence. In late October of 2001, the bin Laden family withdraws from the Carlyle Group, saying that this is bad publicity. By the way, the bin Laden family also have capital participation in a Cambridge, Massachusetts-based biotechnology company. Wonder if they've ever done any research into anthrax. Oh, yes, let's not forget anthrax. Bear in mind that in Serpent's Walk, again, that crazy book that I've been talking about for all these years and that nobody believes anything about, put out by the National Alliance, the top contact group for the NPD in the United States. By the way, the top guy associated with NPD in Germany is a guy named Horst Mahler, previously associated with the Baader-Meinhof gang. He endorsed the Olympics massacre of 1972, and he endorsed the attacks against the World Trade Center. And the NPD, again, he's one of these people associated with the Black September, François Genoux, Islamo-fascist network, including Ahmed Ney, Alfred Huber, whom I've spoken about many times. Hopefully I don't need to go into his background. Of course, in the wake of 9/11, we have some anthrax letters being sent, interestingly enough, to media outlets and Democrats. Another one, apparently, to Patrick Leahy. And that, of course, causes all kinds of problems. It remains to be seen who exactly sent those anthrax letters, but all indications are that they were domestic terrorists, perhaps lone wolves, who knows. The Aryan Nation has devised the strategy of leaderless resistance involving small, unpenetratable cells. But the interesting thing is that there are a lot of interesting things. First of all, the stock of Bayer rose 33%. That's one of the major companies that grew out of IG Farben. Their stock rose 33% because of the sales of Cipro. Bayer is an interesting company. They, of course, developed aspirin. It's their best-known product. Bayer is actually derived from the German adjective for Bavarian, Bayerische. Bayer had also previously developed heroin, which had been developed as a cure for opium addiction, for morphine addiction, rather, and also as a cough suppressant, especially effective in children. Later, Bayer developed a synthetic narcotic, a synthetic opiate for treating casualties on the eve of World War II, because it was believed that the British Navy could successfully blockade the sources of native opium, thereby preventing the Germans from developing enough morphine to treat casualties. That's the standard battlefield treatment for somebody who's been seriously wounded. IG Farben developed a very effective synthetic morphine prior to World War II. It was named in honor of Adolf Hitler. It was called Dolophine, spelled D-O-L-O-P-H-I-N-E. This drug is in wide use in the wake of World War II. It's been renamed, however, now it's called Methadone, and it's used for treating heroin addiction. So it's an interesting... Bayer is a very interesting company indeed. Their stock soars 33% in the wake of the anthrax attacks. It has been disclosed now that one of the major operational centers in Europe was for Al-Qaeda, was Bosnia-Herzegovina, headed up by President Izet Begovic, a member of, as a young man, of the Hanjar Division, the 13th Waffen-SS Division, recruited by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and part of this crew that I've been talking about. The major epicenter for the attacks was Germany. The German authorities had had elements of the Al-Qaeda organization under surveillance for months. They said, well, we just didn't know what it was that we were looking at. Yeah, well, I suspect that's not the case. It's interesting that the attacks appear to have had as their epicenter Hamburg. This might represent a very different kind of Hamburg-America line, which was the Bush family business operated on behalf of the Third Reich. I would note that the anthrax strain that is believed to have been used in the domestic attacks is one called the Ames strain. It's named for Ames, Iowa. It is also heavily researched by the U.S. military in connection with biological warfare. The strain had been on hand for decades, and on October 10th or 11th, it's unclear, the University of Iowa at Ames requested and got permission to destroy their strain archive. They got permission from the FBI to go ahead and do that. They'd had it on hand for decades, and then immediately after the first anthrax attack as a biological warfare weapon in the United States, they destroy the strain, thereby making it impossible to fingerprint this particular strain of anthrax past a point, according to experts. Again, I think that's very, very interesting indeed. I would also note that one of the areas of activism on behalf of Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabi school of Islam, again going back to Muhammad Wahhab, and the Saudis, the House of Saud, King Ibn Saud, the buddy of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, etc., etc. The Wahhabis had been very, very active in the former oil-producing regions of the Soviet Union. In fact, in Chechnya and in the related area of Dagestan, there have been very active Wahhabi sects, because they were many of the leaders of these Wahhabi mosques were educated in, surprise, surprise, Saudi Arabia. And the fighters in Chechnya who attacked Dagestan and who threatened 70% of Russia's shoreline on the Caspian Sea, a huge proven petroleum resource, they were basically Wahhabis. They were associated with people who had been trained in the anti-Soviet Afghan war of the 1980s. Again, the key element in that, it was financed largely through BCCI, and that was the Grand Mufti-founded World Muslim Congress fund that was funded by the Saudi government, and it was the Afghan war that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden and others as warriors. That was also true of the Wahhabi fighters in Chechnya. After 9/11, Vladimir Putin worked out a quid pro quo with George Bush. First of all, Bush acknowledged, he'd been very critical of the Russian conduct of the war in Chechnya, which again, had it successfully succeeded, would have threatened Russian presence on the Caspian Sea. They attacked Dagestan. 70% of Russia's shoreline on the Caspian Sea is in Dagestan. So when the Chechens attacked Dagestan, they were basically threatening a major petroleum lifeline for Russia. George Bush had been very critical, that's the younger George Bush, of the Soviets' conduct of the war in Chechnya. And then Vladimir Putin, after the 9/11 attacks, not only volunteered the use of former bases in the former Soviet Union, he's volunteered up to 250,000 troops, but in exchange, the Bush administration has acknowledged that the Chechens and the Wahhabi element within it are terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda. And in turn, Vladimir Putin then came back at you, so to speak, saying to George W., and he offered Russia's oil reserves and the reserves of the former Soviet Union as an alternative to the petroleum reserves of the former Middle East. And the pipeline that has been proposed by Unocal and British Petroleum, Unocal is the petroleum exploration parent company of Union 76 and Standard Oil of California. One of the major people involved with that in a capital sense is the elder George Bush. And there is a proposed pipeline, a Unocal / BP / Saudi government financed pipeline that is being proposed to take oil from the Caspian Sea, which Vladimir Putin has now given his go-ahead to exploit, and whose Russian sanctity, so to speak, has now been guaranteed by the neutralization, at least for the time being, of the Wahhabi Chechen fighters, allied with, among others, the Saudi Arabians and Osama bin Laden. That pipeline is scheduled to go across Afghanistan. None of the hijackers is from Afghanistan. German intelligence, who, by the way, have made no arrests in connection with this entire affair. They had these houses under surveillance. They're just the German connections are something that I'm going to be documenting in future broadcasts. I talked about them in 326. I came back to them in 331. And I'm going to be talking about them some more in the program that I'm going to record tomorrow. There is an Austrian native who was a roommate of Ziad Jarrah, who was believed to be the pilot of the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, and he's now been placed on the FBI's watch list. And he's complaining. He's saying, just because I was this guy's roommate, how about all the other Germans and Austrians who were coming and going the whole time? The German BKA, the Bundeskriminalamt, estimates that the training camps, the Al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan, have seen 70,000 Islamic terrorists trained there. So whatever happens in Afghanistan, and I do support a military response to this event. It's like World War II. You couldn't just let Pearl Harbor be bombed. On the other hand, when you start looking at who financed World War II, you find that the people who stood a lot to benefit from this were actually helping to finance our enemies. And I think something very similar is true in this war. I think that ultimately, from a geopolitical standpoint, one could think of Al-Qaeda as Africa Corps II, intended to incite Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East, perhaps drive the United States and Britain out of the oil-producing regions of the Middle East to the benefit, ultimately, of Germany, to wipe out Israel. And also, they might be considered, from a geopolitical standpoint, Sixth Army II. The German defeat at Stalingrad took place when the Sixth Army under Friedrich von Paulus was cut off at Stalingrad. The whole idea of that operation was a bold overland thrust by the Sixth Army, and it was to capture Stalingrad, which was seen as the most important railhead controlling the Soviet oil-producing regions of the Caucasus. Some of the same regions now, which are going to be exploited by UNICAL, BP, the Saudi government, and the pipeline across Afghanistan. One could consider, perhaps, from a geopolitical standpoint, or petro-geopolitical standpoint, the accession by Vladimir Putin to not only the American use of bases in the former Soviet Union, but guaranteeing Russian or former Soviet oil to the West as an alternative to the unstable Middle East. One could perhaps consider Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabi fighters in Chechnya, who basically got cashed in exchange for the access to Russian oil and former Soviet oil. One could perhaps consider them Sixth Army II. Their goal geopolitically to secure the Middle Eastern oil reserves, perhaps for Germany. It remains to be seen what ultimately happens, but I suspect that the bombing campaign in Afghanistan is going to spark fierce Muslim hostility. It's known that the father of a Pakistani bomb, let's not lose sight of the fact that Pakistan is a nuclear power, is sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. He, in turn, received critical assistance from a German nuclear expert named Piffle, P-I-F-F-L. It remains to be seen just what exactly happens in the future. I would not be surprised to see the 9-1-1 attacks ultimately followed up by a nuclear incident, not necessarily here, perhaps in Israel or someplace else. I think that long-term, the real manipulator of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic fundamentalists is the underground right. I think they also control the Bush family. I do not think that the Bushes give their orders to Osama bin Laden and the others, but rather I think that Osama bin Laden, the House of Saud, and the Bush family take their orders from the people who are, in fact, in control. And that is the underground right. And that is a longer story. I would have to go into some of the... I'll add a postscript, perhaps. In 1929, there was a major cartel agreement between IG Farben, the Nazi chemical cartel, of which Bayer was a member, maker of Cipro, et cetera, whose stock went up 33% in the wake of the anthrax attacks. They worked out a deal with Standard Oil of New Jersey, the most important of the Standard companies. IG Farben had been working on the hydrogenation process, which was designed to extract oil from coal. Basically, Germany has enormous coal reserves. They do not have domestic petroleum reserves. They were already contemplating another world war. They needed oil to make their war machine run. They didn't have any. IG Farben put a very, very high priority on developing synthetic oil, and they perfected the hydrogenation process to do that. A cartel agreement was worked out in 1929 between Standard Oil of New Jersey and IG Farben. This is talked about, by the way, in All Honorable Men, which is, by the way, that book was the linchpin for Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the broadcast that you heard so many times on KFJC, Miscellaneous Archive Show M11. The cartel agreement between Standard and IG, this is a Standard-IG agreement of 1929, basically worked out the following. And this is a long time ago. This was the year of the stock market crash, the year of the Great Depression, 3 years before Franklin Roosevelt was to be elected president. And basically what it provided was this. IG Farben had sunk a lot of capital into the hydrogenation process. Pardon me, are we operating under a time limitation here? No? Okay, I was just wondering if we have to 11, right? Great, okay, thank you. IG Farben was running out of capital because they had sunk so much investment capital into the hydrogenation process that they were running low on money. They needed capital. On the other hand, they had developed the hydrogenation process, and this represented a potential threat to Standard Oil, because this would have made it possible for anybody to synthesize oil from coal. The cartel agreement provided as follows. IG Farben was made the second largest stockholder in Standard Oil of New Jersey behind the Rockefeller family. They have since increased their participation. IG Farben's shares in Standard were put into the Hermann Schmitz Trust, the chairman of IG, who when he died turned that over to the Bormann Organization. That also includes a critical block of General Motors stock and a number of others. In exchange for becoming the second largest stockholder in Standard of New Jersey, which IG Farben became, giving them a huge block of capital, IG Farben was empowered to market synthetic oil developed from the hydrogenation process in Germany only. But the rights to the hydrogenation process anywhere else in the world, or for hydrogenation-generated oil, went to Standard of New Jersey. Now, this is interesting because this was a cartel agreement back in 1929 about the marketing of synthetic oil, and yet we have not seen this. Germany used synthetic oil for much of its petroleum in World War II. In fact, it was the Leuna refinery in East Germany, what then became East Germany, that was bombed by the 8th Army Air Force.